across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 13, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. With the recall election slated in California for October 7, will one of the two ballot propositions be a step backwards for diversity? And in Iraq, a spate of kidnappings of young girls adds to the chaos of post-war life. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. An organization called Military Families Speak Out launches a new campaign to bring them home now. More with the story from Washington, D.C. is Kuang Fu Tran.
Unified by the large numbers of U.S. soldier deaths by guerrilla warfare and a prolonged period of time that our nation's soldiers patrol Iraq, Military Families Speak Out, Veterans for Peace, and other organizations based in the military community launched a campaign called Bring Them Home Now. This campaign aims to rally military families to write their congressional representatives to end the occupation in Iraq and to send their sons and daughters home. Co-founders Nancy Lesson and Charlie Richardson assembled a group of parents, some of whose children have been killed in Iraq, and others who anxiously await the return of their sons and daughters. Stan Goff, whose son is currently deployed in Iraq, has this to say about the Washington bureaucrats.
This is not the rule of law. This is the rule of bombs and bullets. These are rich men in very expensive suits conducting statecraft like gangsters.
Richardson explicitly said, "Bring them home now" is not a social movement, but a campaign to raise awareness to the government deception that convinced the American people that the war was just. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Kuang Fu Trin.
The American Bar Association, composed of more than 400,000 lawyers, is urging the Bush administration to change some of the rules regarding civilian lawyers defending clients in military tribunals. Jay Tamboli has more from Washington, D.C.
Defendants in military tribunals currently have a choice between a Pentagon-provided military lawyer and a civilian lawyer. But civilian lawyers operate under restrictions that don't apply to their military counterparts. At its annual meeting in San Francisco, the ABA said yesterday that the rules, which prevent civilian lawyers from having full access to information that could exonerate their clients and allow monitoring of attorney-client communications, would prevent defendants in military tribunals from receiving a fair trial. Dennis Archer, president of the ABA, says the current rules are contrary to standard legal practices.
It is not at all consistent with the manner in which we have been used to practicing law and under general accepted treaties, Geneva Convention and things of that nature.
Earlier this month, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers said it would be unethical for lawyers to defend clients under the current rules. The ABA decided to stop short of that determination, but said they were in discussions with the administration about changing the rules. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Jay Tamboli.
Republican senators in Texas trying to end a standoff over congressional redistricting are threatening Democrats with fines of $1,000 a day if they continue blocking a vote on the issue. Renee Feltz has more from KPFT in Houston.
17 Republican senators voted to levy the $1,000 a day fines on their Democratic counterparts. Now known as the Texas 11, they're in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on the 17th day of their attempt to block a vote on redistricting during a 30-day special session. This is the second session called by the state's Republican governor at a cost of over $2.5 million to Texas taxpayers. The fines start Thursday and could reach $57,000 for each senator. Republican lawmakers say the fines must be paid from personal funds and that the 11 Democrats won't be allowed to vote until they're paid. Democrats are refusing to pay and compare the fines to poll taxes once imposed to discourage blacks and Hispanics from voting. They describe their fight as a refusal to abandon over 1 million minority Texans. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations Security Council is expected to vote shortly on a resolution endorsing the U.S.-appointed Governing Council as the transitional authority in Iraq. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
The United States is pushing for a vote by the end of this week on a new resolution that would confer international legitimacy on the handpicked Iraqi administration. The resolution, which has the backing of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, would also provide a mandate for the UN humanitarian mission in Iraq, but would not cede political authority to the UN, as some countries have demanded. Negotiations among the five permanent members of the Security Council are being held at the offices of the U.S. delegation rather than at U.N. headquarters. It's not known whether the talks have been extended to the 10 elected members, including Syria, this month's council president. Earlier this week, the Egyptian foreign minister, after meeting with the Saudi and Syrian foreign ministers, said Arab countries could not recognize the 25-member governing council, composed largely of former exiles with little support within Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
According to a General Accounting Office report, California and several other states with high populations of poor people are disadvantaged by Medicaid's funding formula. More from Kelia Ramirez at Pacifica Radio Station KPFA.
The 40-year-old funding formula compares each state's per capita income to the national average. Lower-income states are given higher federal Medicaid payments in an attempt to equalize the assistance states could offer. But the formula does not consider state-by-state poverty figures or varying costs of health care delivery. As a result, California, Florida, Hawaii, and New York, which together have 31% of the nation's poor, are among the states most hurt by the formula. 13 states benefit, with Alaska and Utah at the top. The report illustrated the funding gap by comparing Wisconsin with California. Both states spend about the same amount of their own money per Medicaid recipient. But when the federal share is added in, Wisconsin, which has a smaller poor population and lower health costs, has a Medicaid budget that is 50% above the national average, while California's Medicaid budget is 26% below the national average. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
While attention in the Californian recall election has focused primarily on close to 250 candidates running to replace Governor Gray Davis, Californians will also face two ballot propositions on the October 7 ballot. They were slated for the next statewide ballot, which would have been March 2004, but were moved up when the recall election was declared. One would ban the state from collecting race-based data, which civil rights groups say would be a step backwards for diversity and social progress. And as Jordan Davis reports from Pacifica Station KPFK, there are concerns that minority voters might be disenfranchised in an election where a ballot proposition that would affect them the most will be decided.
Advocates of California's Proposition 54 call it the Racial Privacy Initiative, and they see that it keeps your racial identity private and will contribute to a colorblind society. But Prop 54 opponents call it the information ban, because the state would be, in most cases, barred from collecting, analyzing, and using racial data. On Monday, outside Los Angeles' City Hall, local politicians joined with a coalition of civil rights groups to voice their opposition to the ballot initiative. They say that it would take the Golden State back to the pre-civil rights era, because the government would lose detailed information about ethnic and minority groups. Elaine Ong from Women Against the Recall says Prop 54 would force the state government to put on blinders.
What's next? The elimination of race data from the U.S. Census? You can't bridge diversity until you acknowledge it. If you don't know the data, you can ignore the problem exists.
Ignorance isn't necessarily bliss. Among the problems critics of Prop 54 say would be hidden from sight, diseases and health problems that are prevalent in some racial and ethnic communities, inequality for minorities in public education, as well as discrimination. Narinyan Singh Khalsa, the Sikh Dharma of Southern California, says Prop 54 would prevent police departments from compiling statistics on hate crimes. And that, he says, would hurt his ability to draw attention to the wave of hate post-9/11.
When I go to Sacramento and I say we are being attacked and discriminated against on a wholesale basis, they say, well, where are the numbers? How can you support what you're saying? If they take this tool away from me, it'll cost the lives of people in my community, because I cannot get the attention of the people who need to change things without these numbers.
Prop 54 has gotten the attention of national civil rights leaders. NAACP Chair Julian Bond traveled to L.A. to speak out on Monday. He attacked the controversial author of the initiative, Ward Connerly. Connerly, an African-American, was the author of Proposition 209, which outlawed affirmative action in the state.
He deceptively called it a civil rights initiative, and many of those who voted for it thought they were casting a vote for affirmative action. Ward Connerly fooled you once. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Don't let the enemies of justice shame you and fool you again.
Because progressive groups see so much at stake with this initiative, they're planning get-out-the-vote operations. But the special recall election itself is under fire from many of the same groups. They say poor and minority voters could be disenfranchised. For example, many cash-strapped California counties are opening far fewer polling places than in a regular election. In largely urban Los Angeles County, where the population is about the size of the state of Michigan, only a third of the usual polling places will be open on October 7th.
You limit access. You make it more difficult for people to vote.
California State Assembly member Mark Ridley Thomas.
People then have to go further to vote, and as a result of that may then be discouraged from voting, which is precisely the opposite effect that's intended according to the Constitution.
But even if the state finds money to open all the polling places, two federal lawsuits say the elections still aren't fair to all voters. The ACLU filed suit saying disenfranchisement by hanging Chad is likely, because many counties, to save money, have reverted to punch cards to count votes. And the addition of initiatives like Proposition 54 to the ballot sparked a lawsuit by the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, or MALDEF. It says four California counties violated the Federal Voting Rights Act because to add propositions to the ballot, the state needed to get approval from the Justice Department or D.C. District Court. Prop 54 was originally scheduled for a statewide vote in the March presidential primaries, and MALDEF wants a federal court to block an earlier vote. MALDEF staff attorney Steve Reyes says that besides the alleged violation of federal law, the rush to organize a statewide election by October jeopardizes services for Latino voters.
This compressed timeline places enormous burdens on county officials to accurately translate, to ensure that the polling places are properly staffed with Spanish speakers, to ensure that nobody is improperly turned away from the polling place. So there's a whole host of things that will likely lead to the disenfranchisement of Latino voters.
With more at stake than just a decision on who will lead the state up for a vote on October 7th, civil rights groups want to make sure minorities get every chance to make their voices heard at the ballot box. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jordan Davis.
A senior Bush administration official today said that it's unclear how long the U.S. occupation of Iraq will last. Paul Bremer, who's leading the occupation in Iraq, told ABC's Good Morning America that the American administration will stay until there's been a constitution written. This as tensions remain high between U.S. soldiers and Iraqis. In the last 24 hours, three more U.S. soldiers have been killed, with no count on the number of Iraqi civilians killed. Meanwhile, as we continue to hear about the lack of security and order in Iraq, what has not been reported is the rash of kidnappings across Baghdad, especially of young women, by organized gangs. Many families say they're worried about the fate of their daughters and sons, and they keep constant watch over them lest kidnappers approach their loved ones. Ahmed Al-Rawi reports from Baghdad.
20-year-old Arij is like most students at Al-Tahaddi School in Al-Mansur district in Baghdad. For Arij and her classmates, focusing on schoolwork and gaining an education are increasingly difficult, given the current dangers of life in Iraq. Arij recalls a recent incident when her mother came to pick her up at school.
We finished a lecture at about 12 o'clock noon. We walked to the main street to catch a cab when suddenly an Oldsmobile passed by with four men inside. They parked the car near us and an armed man approached us. He pointed his gun at my mother and told her to let me go. He pulled me and my mother shouted loud. I don't know what happened to me. It was as if my legs were paralyzed while I was shaking. My mother pulled me from one side and he pulled from another. He told my mother, let her go, release her. He fired once from his gun, followed by a second and then a third time. Because of the sound of the shooting, the staff of Dar al-Salam Hospital went outside to see what was happening. He shot actually four bullets. Seeing all the attention they had drawn, the other men inside the car called the armed man and they drove away.
Arid says her family did not bother to report the incident to any official policing bodies or to the American military police.
What shall we report? To whom shall we report? There is no use in reporting. There is no government. To whom shall we report and to whom shall we complain?
Arij's mother, who follows her daughter like her shadow, now carries a gun in her suitcase for the sole reason of protecting her daughter. She says,
even if there is a checkpoint where the Americans find me with this gun, I will tell them I'm protecting myself because there is no one to guard me. I will show them the gun myself. Why should they consider that I am hiding a weapon? When did we reach this level of debasement?
Basil Behnam, the owner of Atlas Publishing House, was also abducted recently. His family paid $40,000 in ransom for his safe return. Since being released, Basil has been interviewed once, but he refused later to be interviewed because he was threatened by the suggestion that his young child would be kidnapped. He and his family are now living outside of Iraq since he finds life in the country unsafe. Human Rights Watch has issued a statement expressing concern over the dangers of this new wave of kidnappings. The group's Baghdad spokesperson is Hani Mejali.
This is part of a crime wave in Baghdad. Certainly it seems to be something new for women to be abducted in broad daylight.
Human Rights Watch has reminded the American administration of its obligation to address this situation. It says that the U.S. occupying power has this responsibility to preserve law and order according to the Fourth Geneva Convention. Again, Hani Mejali.
The whole international community has been reminding the coalition forces here, the United States in particular, that there is an obligation to safeguard the civilian population and protect the civilian population. And clearly, whereas the war might have been won, the peace has yet to be won. And the problem has been that the manpower was not here, the translators were not here, the planning was really for the war, but once the war was over, they didn't seem to have had a plan for how to conduct themselves post-war.
The press office of the American administration in Iraq refused to comment on this sensitive topic. Many Iraqis say that despite public services still desperately lacking, establishing safety and security remain the most pressing needs in Iraqi society today. This is Ahmed Arawi in Baghdad.
Early this morning, the Israeli army demolished the family home of Faisal Jarwan, the father of Hamas Jarwan, who detonated explosives he was carrying at the entrance of a busy shopping center in the town of Ras Al Ain in Israel on Tuesday, killing one Israeli and injuring 10 others. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade took responsibility for this attack. A second bombing took place at a bus stop near the Israeli settlement of Ahriel in the occupied West Bank. One Israeli settler was killed and four others were injured. As these incidents of violence continue to be reported as breaking the ceasefire implemented by the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap negotiations, Mohammed Halaini reports from Gaza, where the Hamas leader Abdelaziz Rantizi says very little has changed for Palestinians as the so-called peace negotiations continue.
Dr. Abdelaziz Rantizi, a senior political leader of Hamas, told Free Speech Radio News that the latest bombing in the Israeli settlement of Ariel in the occupied West Bank was a direct response to the Israeli invasion of the Askar refugee camp outside of Nablus last Friday. That raid killed two men identified with Hamas and two civilian bystanders.
Almost 10 days ago, we issued a communique stating that our commitment to the truce does not mean at all that we will not respond to terrorist attacks carried out by the Israeli army. This means that even though we are still committed to the truce, we will respond to every aggression by the Israeli military. Therefore, the ceasefire or Hudna is still valid.
Since Palestinian leaders announced the unilateral ceasefire on June 30, the Israeli army has carried out several small-scale incursions into areas in the Gaza Strip where security responsibilities in urban areas fall upon the Palestinian Authority. The Israeli government has said it reserves the right to carry out military operations in areas where the Palestinian Authority does not have full security control. Dr. Rantizi responded to this by saying,
the Zionists have become accustomed to spilling the blood of Palestinian children, women, and men, old and young, and to the destruction of property and siege. Any aggression against the Palestinian people is a breach of this ceasefire. Otherwise, we could say that the Hudna applies only to Jaffa and Haifa and not to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Today, Palestinian women demonstrated in Nablus just days after the Israeli raid that killed four Palestinians in the Askar refugee camp. They also called for the release of the remaining Palestinian detainees. Also today, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said the U.S.-backed peace process will dissolve if the Palestinian Authority does not remove Yasser Arafat from a leadership role. Sharon continued to say it will, quote, continue to strike at terrorists if the Palestinian Authority does not, end quote. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mohammed Ghalayini in Gaza.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has warned that illicit trafficking in radioactive materials in Africa is posing an increasing security threat. Radioactive materials can be used to make dirty bombs, and dirty bombs disperse harmful radioactive materials. IAEA's warning comes amid rising international concern about terrorists acquiring dirty bombs. Nigeria, where Western oil companies have been losing radioactive materials, is one of the African countries under the IAEA spotlight. Samuel Okoya reports from Nigeria's Niger Delta region.
Western oil companies operating in Nigeria's Niger Delta region have a record of losing radioactive materials they are supposed to use in their oil fields. In March, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, sent a mission to Nigeria to search for radioactive materials that went missing while being transported by the American company Halliburton. The company had earlier kept the loss secret. Like Halliburton, another American company, ExxonMobil, also lost radioactive materials and concealed the loss. These are no isolated cases. Nuclear physicist Abisin Abie, who is national coordinator of Nigerian Society for Radiological Protection, says it is difficult to determine the quantity of missing radioactive materials in the Niger Delta because the oil companies have been concealing their losses.
You have a situation where, for now, government is not in a position to monitor every loss of radioactive material. So what government talks about is the ones that are notified to them, or at least the ones that become a public knowledge. Most of the time when these things happen and nobody's aware, the people keep quiet about it.
There is no clue as to where the missing radioactive materials in the Niger Delta are ending. The IAEA is concerned that trafficking in radioactive materials in Africa make them a potent weapon for terrorists. In the past years, terrorists have struck soft Western targets in Africa. Jaye Geske of the local environmental rights action says the frequent loss of radioactive materials in the Niger Delta has security implications.
There are actually security implications for some of these issues, particularly in two types of instances. One, in the case where these radioactive materials are lost in transit. In this instance, they have not been put to any use. So the issue is that whole packages of radioactive materials just disappear in transit between two points. Now, that can be very problematic because nobody accounts for where these things have gone to. There is no effort on the part of the oil companies and on the part of the government to recover these materials that have been declared missing.
Communities in the Niger Delta have often raised concern over missing radioactive materials and deadly substances abandoned on their land by the oil companies. In Erovia community, the villagers say more than 90 people died after being exposed to a dangerous substance dumped there by the oil company Shell. William Oketa says he is ill as a result of the substance.
I'll be having a heart problem in a, that is respiratory problem. I've all the time been feverish, cough every now and then. Then general weakness of the body. Some cases I feel very dizzy. Used to be very energetic, but now, with any little exercise I get myself involved in, I feel very tired. I'm no longer as strong as I used to be.
Both the Nigerian government and the oil companies are yet to address concerns over the implication of frequent loss of radioactive materials and the careless handling of other deadly waste. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in the Niger Delta.
Less than 6 months after a study by Indian NGO, the Centre for Science and Environment, or CSE, found high levels of pesticides in bottled water, the same organisation now finds similar results with the two cola giants, Coke and Pepsi. CSE's latest report reveals that Coke and Pepsi contain levels of pesticides unfit for human consumption, according to World Health standards. The rival companies immediately joined forces to vehemently deny the allegations and are suing the CSE. But the damage has already been done as protests are emerging around India to expel the multinationals from the world's second most populous country. Today we begin a two-part series looking at the Coca-Cola company in India, first with correspondent Binu Alex in Ahmedabad.
Pepsi, it's time to grab a Pepsi.
For some, it's time to grab something else. In late 70s, a left-leaning government ordered the Coke Corporation out of India. After liberalization in the late 80s, Coke Corporation returned to India with its rival, Pepsi, and dominated more than 90% of Indian beverage market. But today, Coke and Pepsi companies are facing a litmus test after the latest findings of pesticide residues in its bottled drinks. New Delhi-based NGO Center for Science and Environment, or CSC, tested 12 random samples of bottled Coke and Pepsi. The test concluded that the sodas contained residues of extremely toxic pesticides and insecticide, which included potent carcinogens that can cause cancers and reduce bone mineral density. Sunita Narayan is the director of CSC.
Where do they take water and from which community? There should be some control and regulations over it, and proper rules should be made.
The Coke and Pepsi Corporation combated the news of these studies with newspaper advertisements saying pesticide residues in the sodas are well within the limits set by the European Union for water consumption. The cola giants have threatened to sue the Center for Science and Environment based on the studies it released. In a joint move, both Coke and Pepsi Corporation said there may be a desire to create panic and deliberate scare behind the report. Sanjeev Gupta is the CEO of Coca-Cola India Operations.
We went and tested our products according to the best techniques. We were absolutely fine. So that is why we are amazed.
Now, Indian states, one after another, have ordered cola samples to be tested, and if found positive, have promised strict action against the cola giants. The South Indian state of Kerala have banned it from all government-owned restaurants. Maharashtra government has already been sued by Coke for its damaging step to send cola samples for testing. Yesterday, the Indian Parliament in New Delhi has banned these colas from its premises. E. Ahmed is the member of Parliament in charge of Food Committee.
All members cutting across party lines have agreed to move these beverages out. The members have expressed their anger and anguish on these poisonous drinks, and as per their demand, I have banned them.
Both corporations together have invested close to $3 billion in the growing Indian cola market. But after the study, sales for Coke and Pepsi have already come down, as per reports appearing in the media. The government said it has already sought comprehensive tests outside of those already conducted by the CSC. V.K. Malhotra is the spokesperson for the ruling BJP party.
Pesticides in Coke and Pepsi and such adulterations are serious and should be properly investigated.
The issue has become a national debate as parliamentarians have also demanded strict action against the cola manufacturers. Critics of the latest news about the pesticide accuse Coke and Pepsi and other multinational corporations like Dow Chemicals for taking advantage of poorer countries like India. Raj Babar is a parliamentarian.
This is a case of attempted murder. These companies should be immediately banned.
Together, Pepsi and Cola corporations own more than 12 popular brand sodas, selling 500 million bottles every year. That's 90% of the carbonated drinks market. For the 40% of India's 1 billion population, which lacks access to clean drinking water, this report will hardly create an impact.
Coca-Cola, Pio Thanda, Jio Thanda.
From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to FSRN. I'm Deepa Fernandez.